The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
There's a ceremonial side of Seoul which I've rather surreally encountered completely by chance in one of the two royal palaces. We're standing in the huge central square and there's a procession of warriors dressed in bright blue, red and green silk with huge pennants.
Reunited after being separated for over six decades. South Koreans have crossed the border with the North to meet with family members. The Korean War in the early 1950s divided the country between a communist North and capitalist South. Many families became permanently separated, unable to contact each other even by phone. The reunion waiting list has thousands of names.
I've been fascinated by South Korea ever since I met up with some of its publishers at a UNESCO conference a few years back. A country of smartphones and smarter people, of trains that run on time and internet access for all. We're ideally placed to be the world's information highway of the 21st century, they chorused. Too good to be true? Well, as soon as I heard that it was to be the guest country at this year's London Book Fair, I just knew I had to go and find out for myself. So here I am in Seoul, in a hotel across the road from the Japanese embassy, where a history of imperial exploitation is reflected in a round-the-clock protest about reparations to comfort women. That's Korean women who were conscripted into sexual slavery during the Second World War. It's a polite sort of protest in a polite sort of city, a city of gleaming skyscrapers and multi-lane highways, of small book cafes and huge public artworks, whose philosophy seems to be that business and pleasure do mix. Its biggest bookshop is in the basement of an insurance company. I'm familiar with a few of its writers, with the economist Ha Jun Chang, for example, author of the cheekily titled 2010 book 23 Things They Don't Tell You About Capitalism, and the short story writer Chris Lee, whose haunting debut collection, The Drifting House, told of different sorts of horrors both north and south of the border. But I want to know more. Who are the writers that can hold their own against the singers, with which, like it or not, we're all now familiar? Here's one of them, the portly 40-year-old Tsai proclaiming his love of country. The song goes, "The sounds of 50,000, it's the sound of the Korean peninsula. Lift it up, get it up, this is Korea." K-pop is shorthand for Korean pop music, and the name of Psy's most famous song, Gangnam Style, comes from a district of Seoul which is famous for being home to the country's nouveau riche. It's also home to an international cosmetic surgery industry, a business so brash and brazen that one clinic was recently reported to have made a foyer art display of cheekbones removed from its patients. But we're not here for the surgery, we're here for the books. All eyes will be on Korea this month as 10 of its leading writers come to the London Book Fair under a market-focused collaboration between the British Council and Korea's own Literature Translation Institute, which just happens to have its scholarly library-style headquarters among the gleaming teeth and sculpted faces of Gangnam. So I turned to one of the country's top translators, a native Cornishman but naturalised Korean monk, Brother Anthony, to ask what's so special about modern Korean literature.
I think the most important thing about Korean writing is that it is rooted in history. It's a history of pain, of separation, of tragedy, of drama, something that you can't even begin to imagine in Europe. All the Korean writing that was done until very recently reflected the experience of humiliation under the Japanese, and then after a moment of hope, confusion, violence, the outbreak of Korean War, which led to the division of not just of the country, but of thousands of families divided between North and South, and then the drama of dictatorships, the destruction of the traditional rural communities, because you start industrializing, everybody moves into the cities to work in the factories. And so Korean history is full of these dramas of separation, uprooting, and of loss of identity and the need to hold on to some kind of essential human dignity.
I've been meeting lots of novelists and even a Webtoons graphic novelist on this trip. What sort of relative values would you give these different forms of literature today?
Everybody today looks at novels, the fiction. So few people in any country really read poetry and expect anything from poetry. Actually, in Korea, traditionally, poetry was the thing. And if you look at the list of books published, translations of Korean literature published in the last 14 years, almost half of them are poetry. And I think that's because actually Korean poetry is more interesting, I would say, than a lot of Korean fiction. Korean fiction is going to be rooted in Korean reality, whether it's living in apartment blocks or it's losing your family in the war. But it's very Korean. And the way it's told is not always so subtle. It's sometimes deeply sentimental. But Korean poetry tends to be much more personal, real. I mean, there are people who write beautiful poetry. There was a big fight about that in Korean literary circles. You know, should poetry and literature be beautiful or should it be related to reality? Actually, of course, it's both. The answer is both, and everybody agrees that the answer is both. But Korean poetry is accessible even to people who might not actually get round to reading fiction, especially because the best of Korean fiction is short stories.
Why do you think the short story is so successful here?
It's easier to control. There is, of course, one Korean novel, or two or three, actually, that fill 17 volumes. Roman Fleuve, The Vengeance, but they are actually entirely episodic. There is no overall structure apart from just time. Koreans or writers are all the time dealing with chronological succession of this and this and then this, then this, then this. So at least the short story, you sort of got it contained within certain limits.
Brother Anthony there with a classical perspective on Korean literature. One more recent form that's garnering an international youth following almost as big and just as devoted as K-pop is Korea's very own type of comic book. It's called manhwa, and it's similar to Japanese manga, only less commercialised according to its fans. Aptly for a country that's home to some of the world's most powerful smartphone brands, it's a literature for the mobile age, which is first published as webtoons, installments designed to be read on phones.
엄마, 도장 좀 줘.
왜? 줘봐봐, 그냥. 이유를 알아주지, 그냥 먹자.
이유는 무슨 이유? 자기 딸 그렇게 못 믿어?
Only when the stories have been thoroughly road-tested by thousands of phone readers are they compiled into graphic novels. One of the stars of this new firmament is Yoon Tae-ho, whose most recent novel is a portrayal of the sad life of the Korean salaryman. It's titled Miseng, which roughly translates as weakling, and its subtitle is An Incomplete Life. The dark side of Korea's economic miracle, which is only 60 years old, as I'm constantly reminded, is that it's built on a culture of corporate drudgery with impossibly long hours and unfaltering devotion to the company hierarchy, as a display of Yoon's work reveals.
The Salaryman is a regular character in Korean soap opera and other media, but the stories are often very unrealistic, with exaggerated situations and unlikely love stories. My story isn't about heroes, but about individuals who ask questions. How do I survive in this society, and what does it mean to live a good life? These are things my readers can identify with. When they see these characters in my work, they see themselves. So the theme is self-reflection. What is my dream, and how did I lose my dream? This quality has meant it has come to be seen as a sort of self-help book by my readers. I've never actually been a salaryman. I made my debut in 1993, and it's possible to make a good living from webtoons. I made about 10 million Korean won a month, just from the Miseng series. In Korea, the portal sites are different to those anywhere else in the world. They're like a living room. People stay there and live on the site. So when a particular work meets with great success, the graphic work itself sometimes becomes a space for advertising. In the case of Miseng, some of my characters are used to advertise coffee, stationery products and diaries. All of the products that are used by salarymen.
We don't have anything quite like webtoons in the UK, so I asked a young fan, Yunjun King, to explain their appeal.
Webtoon is online format of graphic novel style, and people just instantly read the images, and then they can comment on their series. So they can communicate with the writer or the cartoonist. The writers also can see what the readers think. It's very huge boom in Seoul and wider Korea. A lot of people read cartoon online. And I heard that according to the report by Ministry of Culture, the reader of the graphic novel online soared by 10%. I always read this kind of cartoon on the bus when I commute.
On your telephone?
Yeah, sure, on mobile.
And then would you buy the book if you'd read it on your phone, or do you find it's not necessary to read the book?
Sometimes I found some great work that I want to keep it in my shelf. So sometimes I buy those kind of books from the bookstore, offline bookstore.
Miseng might be new in form and technology, but it's not new in its critique of social conformity or in its adoption of an anti-hero as its central character. Here's a scene from Yi Munyol's award-winning 1987 novella, Our Twisted Hero. Our Twisted Hero, an unreliable narrator, if ever there was one, has just enrolled in a provincial school after his father was forced to leave Seoul in disgrace. It's not long before he has his first run-in with the class monitor.
It was almost as if Sok Dae could read my heart. He asked me about my father's job and our family circumstances. As a result, without any impression of putting on undue airs, I was able to tell the others my father ranked next to the county manager in the local administration, and that we lived comfortably with a radio and three clocks, including the pendulum clock on the wall. Good. Well, let's see. Sok Dae folded his arms like an adult, giving me the impression that he had something in mind. He pointed to a desk in the row in front of his own. "You sit there," he said. "That's your place." I was a bit taken aback. "The teacher told me to sit back there," I said, suddenly remembering how things were in Seoul, but no longer feeling the same combative spirit I'd felt just a few moments ago. Sok Dae let my objection pass as if he hadn't heard. "Hey, Kim Yong-soo, change places here with Han Pyong-tae." At Sok Dae's bidding, the boy gathered his things into his bag without a word. The absolute obedience of the boy overwhelmed me once again. I hesitated for a moment, but thinking my hesitation might be construed as resistance, I changed places. There were at least two other things that day that really boggled my mind. One of them happened at lunchtime. When my conversation with Sok Dae was over, he put his lunchbox up on the desk. This was the signal for everyone to open their lunch boxes. Five or six in the group proceeded to bring things over to Sock Day. Among the things they put on his desk were some steamed sweet potatoes and eggs, roasted peanuts and some apples. Finally, one boy in the front row poured some water into a porcelain cup and placed that too, respectfully, on Sock Day's desk. Everyone behaved as they would to the teacher on a picnic. Sock Day accepted everything without a single word of thanks. The most he did was give a little smile to the boy who had brought the eggs. The second thing happened during the break after the fifth period, when two boys in the section of the class next to me got into a fight and one of them got a bloody nose. Immediately, the boys who were looking on went to find Sock Day, who had left the classroom before the fight broke out. It was just like soul children going for the teacher when they encountered something they could not handle. The way Sock Day handled the affair when he returned was not very different from the way a teacher would. He stuffed the boy's bleeding nose with a wad of cotton wool from the first aid box. Then he got him to hold his head back. He slapped the boy who had caused the nosebleed and made him kneel down on the dais with his arms raised. Both boys followed Sock Day's directives quietly, as if it were all perfectly normal. Even more strange was the teacher's attitude when he came in for the sixth period. After listening quietly to Sock Day's report, he took the stick that was used to clean the blackboard duster and gave the offender several hard slaps across the palms. In this way, the teacher endorsed what seemed to me to be flagrantly inappropriate behaviour on Sock Day's part. When I came home from school that day, I began again to examine carefully this new order and environment. A certain mental paralysis, the result of being thrown suddenly into a very strange school environment, and a feeling of being threatened by the rigidity of this new order, which now suddenly was weighing down on me, filled my head with a kind of fog. Everything was so fuzzy that I couldn't think. Although at 12, it's still easy enough to treat everything with the innocence of a child, I had the feeling I wouldn't be able to transfer into this new order and environment. What had happened violated completely the principles of reason and freedom by which I had been reared all my life. I had not yet experienced directly the full brunt of Sock Day's order, but I had more than a vague presentiment of the irrationality and violence I would have to endure after accepting it. It all seemed like a horrible pre-arranged plan that was destined to become reality.
Han Pyeongtae there getting a tough lesson in the school of life. Yi's family was split up when his father defected for North Korea, leaving his family to fend for themselves in the south, as Yi explained.
My father was a well-read man during the Japanese colonial era, and he felt Marxism was the most effective way for us to achieve liberalization and establish ourselves as a new nation. His views meant that there was a lot of hatred towards us, so my father could no longer live in the south. He was one of the many intellectuals who were forced to move north for ideological reasons at that time, and there are still many families in South Korea whose fathers defected. Many of them were at the recent reunion of families, which you may have heard about. I've registered for the reunion, but I'm too young.
Yi's life story is a twisted version of the tale told to every visitor to South Korea about defectors from the north who arrive traumatized and destitute from the evil empire across the border. It was a story that was to take me on one of the world's strangest and most sinister tourist trips, to an area forbidden to most South Korean citizens, the demilitarized zone that lies a mere 60 kilometers or so from Seoul.
Number two, and this meant monitoring you guys at this time. So please do not point, wave, or gesture towards North Korea. If you look at the base of the hill, you will see the multiple white stakes standing 1 meter in height and spaced out at 10 meter interval. This marks the MDL line throughout Compass Row, bisects each building with a 17 by 5 inch slab of concrete. Line with the building to your right. This is the North Korean Recreation Center.
I'm standing in the northernmost tip of South Korea. To my left is the shrine. Ooh, that sounded like gunfire. To the left is the shrine where people who left family behind in the north come to pray for reunification.
to my right is a rusty train which was apparently stranded in the demilitarized zone during the war. In front of me is the Freedom Bridge, where the exchange of prisoners took place at the end of the Korean War in 1953. It's a crude wooden structure which looks as if it could have been built for a Hollywood film, and that's because it was purpose-built to replace the old bridges which had been blown up in the war. It's flanked by wire fences, which are threaded with bright fluttering ribbons left by people whose families are still in North Korea. Also wishes from other countries blighted by partition. There's one here that says, good wishes from Bangladesh.
Off to his left, it is kind of split open, the curtain. The other guard is in there taking pictures of you guys right now. That's why we do tell you guys in favor to do the same thing back to them, take their pictures as well.
Behind the fence, I can just see a walkway, and there are two very young soldiers walking along it. They're now standing beside a small machine gun emplacement, chucking stones like any bored teenagers. Behind me there's a deserted funfair just by the border where the families can leave their children while they visit the shrine. And there's a tourist booth over there selling folk art purses and DMZ caps. It's hard to imagine anyone having fun here. It's one of the saddest places I've ever seen. That's taped music coming from a church, which I've just seen some people who look like GIs going into. And now I'm going to enter radio silence as we board a military bus to go into the joint administration sector. The next stage of the journey was even stranger, ending in a small blue shed with a door at each end, one of which opens onto North Korea and the other onto the south. Only one door can be opened at any one time, and groups of tourists are invited under the watchful eye of each country's elite militia to cross the border, which falls in the middle of a bank of conference tables laid out in symbolic readiness for the reunification talks. No bags or recording equipment is allowed, though as guests of South Korea you can take pictures, provided your camera is pointed to the north.
The signing ceremony of the armistice agreement was held in July 27th.
Back in the comfort of a Seoul coffee shop, I asked the distinguished novelist Hwang Seok-yong whether he thought North and South would ever be reconciled.
Reunification is the long, long way, I think. Now we need a peace system. A peace system is the first step of our future.
Hwang was born in 1943 in Manchuria, when this area of what is now China was under Japanese occupation. During the South Korean dictatorships that followed the war, he was imprisoned for 5 years for his support of the pro-democracy movement. Hwang refuses to take easy positions on the political rights and wrongs of his divided country. His novel The Guest, first published in 2001, takes a metaphor that used to be applied to smallpox, an unwanted Western guest if ever there was one, and reapplies it to a story of two more recent foreign arrivals, Marxism and Christianity, which he believes have split Korea in two. It's a story of war, homecoming and exorcism, involving the efforts of two brothers to make peace with their family's traumatic past. Here is Hwang's introduction.
I began work on The Guest in 2000, the 50th anniversary of the Korean War. The September 11th attacks a year later came directly after The Guest was first published and the onset of this new Age of Terror, along with the inclusion of North Korea in the so-called Axis of Evil and the beginning of a whole new war, made the fragility of our position clearer than ever. It was a chilling experience to be so reminded that despite the collapse of the Cold War infrastructure, our small peninsula is still bound by the delicate chains of war. Because of Korea's identity as both a colony and a divided nation, both Christianity and Marxism were unable to achieve natural, spontaneous modernization. Instead, they were forced to reach modernity in accordance with conscious human will. In North Korea, where the legacy of class structure during the traditional period was relatively diluted compared to the South, the tenets of Christianity and Marxism were zealously adopted as facets of enlightenment. During the Korean War, the area of North Korea, known as Hwanghae Province, was the setting of a 50-day nightmare, during which Christians and communists, two groups of Korean people whose lives were shaped by two different guests, committed a series of unspeakable atrocities against each other. Today, in a district known as Sinchon in Hwanghae Province, there stands a museum that indicts the American military for the massacre of innocents. The literal translation of the museum's name is the American Imperialist Massacre Remembrance Museum. Many years ago, when I visited the North, I was given a tour of this museum as a matter of course. Later on, during my stay in New York, I met a Korean minister named Ryu and heard the eyewitness account of his childhood in Hwanghae Province. Not too long afterwards, in Los Angeles, I was lucky enough to meet another survivor who shared with me her detailed first-hand account of the actual wartime incident that led to the founding of the aforementioned museum. As it turns out, the atrocities we suffered were committed by none other than ourselves, and the inner sense of guilt and fear sparked by this incident helped form the roots of the frantic hatred that thrives to this day. Less than 5 years ago, when I first completed The Guest, I received fierce attacks from both Southern and Northern statists. The scars of our war and the ghosts of the Cold War still mar the Korean Peninsula. I can only hope that this particular exorcism helps us all move a step closer to a true, lasting reconciliation as the new century unfolds.
Hwang frames his novel in part as a ghost story in what has been described as an ambitious exploration of a post-war survivor's chaotic psyche. The all-too-recent horrors of Korean history mean that its writers don't always write directly. Yi Mun-yeol's Our Twisted Hero, which we heard about earlier, is in a distinguished tradition of political commentary disguised as apparently naive fable. One of the most recent additions to this genre is a novella, The Hen Who Dreamed She Could Fly, which has become an international bestseller and has now been made into an animated film. Here's how we first encounter the plucky sprout.
The Hen Who Dreamed She Could Fly. Sprout liked to stare out into the barnyard. She would much rather watch the ducks scuttle away from the dog than peck at the feed. Closing her eyes, she imagined herself wandering freely about. She fantasized about sitting in a nest, on an egg, about venturing into the fields with the rooster, and about following the ducks around. She sighed. It was pointless to dream. It would never happen to her. She had not been able to lay an egg for the past few days. This was no surprise, since she could barely get to her feet. On the fifth day without an egg, Sprout woke up from a deep sleep to hear the farmer's wife grousing, "We need to cull it. Take it out of the coop." Sprout had never thought she would leave the coop. She didn't understand the word cull, but the thought of getting out of the coop gave her a burst of energy. She lifted her head with effort and sipped some water. The next day, too, she failed to lay an egg. Sprout could sense it. Her body could no longer make eggs. But still, she took in a bit of water and feed. She couldn't wait for her new life to begin. She would hatch an egg and raise a chick. She could do it if only she could get out into the yard. She waited, brimming with anticipation. She slept fitfully, imagining playing in the fields with the rooster and scratching at the ground. The following day, the door to the coop opened and the farmer and his wife entered, pushing an empty wheelbarrow. Sprout was so weak she couldn't stand up straight, but mentally she was sharper than ever before. She raised her voice for the first time in a long while. "I'm flying the coop," she clucked. The most wonderful day since she was shut in the coop had dawned. The scent of the acacias filled the air. "We can probably get something for the meat, right?" the farmer's wife asked her husband. "I'm not sure. It looks sickly."
Well, as you probably guessed, Sprout does escape and manages to hatch an egg. Is this a simple story for children, an allegory of motherhood, as the film suggests, or a piece of feminist wish fulfillment? Its author, Hwang Soon-mi, explained.
You could say it fits into the third category because it's a female character on a journey to find the life that she can lead according to her own desire and her own will. However, rather than it being specifically about a woman, it's the story of a person who is determined to follow their dreams. The film version sees it as a film about motherhood, but that was their view. At the time when I wrote this book, there was a children's book boom, so strategically it was published as a children's book, which is why so many children ended up reading it. I was elated when I heard that in the US my book would be published as an adult novel.
Motherhood is an important theme for Korea's women writers. As Kyung Suk Shin, author of the best-selling Please Look After Mother, told me. In this novel, the disappearance of a mother suffering from Alzheimer's makes her children appreciate her for the first time, while forcing them to face up to years of selfish neglect. It opens with a line to shiver the heart of any good Korean. It has been a week since mother went missing. Kyung Suk Shin was born in 1963 and was part of the so-called 386 generation, who were involved in the pro-democracy demonstrations through the 1980s. Like many of her peers, she has not had children. Korea has the lowest birth rate in the developed world, partly as a result of the hard choices this hard-working, ambitious culture forces on its women. "Mothers are heroic figures," she says. "They gave up everything for us. But who would want to do that now?" And so, as my time in Korea comes to an end, I'm left with a story so much more complicated than the one I arrived with. I've seen wealth and beauty and state-of-the-art technological can-do. I've also seen those fluttering memorial ribbons in the demilitarized zone. Perhaps, as Hwang Seok-yong elegantly puts it, to understand Korea, you have to stand in the middle of the DMZ. But who can do that today? One man who did, and lived to tell the tale, just, was a poet, Chon Sang-pyong, a sort of 20th century John Clare, who emerged from years of prison and asylums with a body of haunting folk poetry, some of which has been posthumously translated by Brother Anthony. We end this podcast with his poem, Letter.
Letter. With my stomach full after eating lunch, I'm writing this letter to the once hungry me. It used to happen sometimes. You won't be upset, will you? There were times of luxury too, you know. I hope you won't forget that. I was sure of tomorrow for 20 years. Now that I'm full, I'm worried I might forget all that. So I'm writing this letter.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.